Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Breaking Absolutes. I am Peter Arulian. This is my show that I get to pretty heavily editorialize who I bring on. And I do that because my purpose is to talk to musicians and artists whose work I think is deserving of a broader audience, that I think is doing interesting things in the rock and metal genre. And for that, want to spend time dimensionalizing the artist so that we get to know them better and become fans of them and all the things they do, and not only the things for which they're, you know, most celebrated. So with that as my setup, today I get to talk to Doug Pinnick. I've been a fan of Doug and his music for a long, long time, and really pleased to get to have the chance to talk to him. Before I bring him on, let me just do a little setup for those who are either unfamiliar or less familiar with sort of the long and storied career of this musician. You know, he's known, him and the projects that he's associated with, you'll hear mentioned as a musician's musician. And we'll talk about this a little bit with Doug when he comes on, but it's pretty high praise, and it's something that's been an appellation that he's lived up to his entire career. The group King's X, which was sort of the breakout music project, they were ranked number 83 in the VH1's 100 Greatest Hard Rock Artists Ever. Their albums Faith, Hope, and Love and Dogman both charted in top 100 Billboard. They've toured with Cheap Trick, Maiden, AC/DC, Scorpions, Pearl Jam, Motley Crue. I say these things because I think it's important to see the association of, and peers that have regard for their music and have wanted to share a bill with them. Doug's also done a huge number of collaborations, and we'll talk with him a little bit about that. I think this also nods to people who appreciate Doug's musicianship and are eager for the chance to work with him. A couple of little fun things before I bring him on. He had a song that was part of back when late night talk show was a cool thing. The Late Show with David Letterman, they had a tune, We Were Born to Be Loved, that ran a long time there. They've had music in other films like Bill and Ted's Journey. And there's just a number of chart positions that really show that these guys have earned the respect of the industry. So with that as my preamble, let me go ahead and bring Doug on and we'll have our conversation. Doug, welcome.
Hey.
Hey, man. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. It's been a fan for a long, long time. Excuse me. I remember when the first few albums of King's X came out, and me and all of my, you know, I'm a musician myself, and all through the circles, there was this buzz. Everybody started talking about this music, and it was unique, and there was such regard in the music community, in the musicians community, for what you were doing. Did this in any way sort of surprise you that you had this like this almost immediate regard in your peer set?
It was a complete surprise. I mean, so much that I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
I just didn't even think they'd tell that to everybody, you know, and I just kept on doing what I did for many, many years.
Yeah. I mean, it's it's one thing to have commercial success. And to be really honest with you, for as much success as you have, I don't think that and I don't say this very often, but I don't think that is for all the success you've had that you've had the commercial success that you deserve for the musical contributions you make and how unique the music is. And of course, I mean, I think I'm not talking out of school. I saw in some of the materials, you're 71. You look younger than me. I don't know how you do this.
Thanks.
But this, you just have this, this long storied career. And I'm hoping that conversations like this can bring you even new artists, because the music is so good. And we're going to get to Joy Bomb, which is your new effort. But I want to talk about some things first.
Okay, sure.
But the I want to start from the beginning. I remember when I first heard your music, without knowing anything about your backstory, I could have guessed some of the influences, because and some of this that I will say is not new, but there's a soulfulness in your music that nods to a gospel background. There's a part of your music that feels very much like British Invasion music, and there's so much of it that nods to the Beatles. There's stuff that's early Zep and some of that early, early rock. And then you've got this Motown thing going. Like you got, I hear blues all through your music, and it's not blues, but it nods to blues. And I mean, this blend is, I can't think of another artist that does this. And I don't know if this was.
I call it the groove.
I like that.
That's all. I always say, may the groove be with you, because everything I do has a groove to it. And that's, and that comes from everything, you know. I mean, everything that I do has to have that groove, because that's just me. That's my take on everything, no matter what it is. Even if it's Meshuggah, when I find the one, I'll dance my ass off to him, you know, because it's all about the groove. No matter what it is, it has to groove. I think of Pantera a lot of times and go, yeah, they knew exactly what to do, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a, I hadn't heard, you've probably said that before. I hadn't heard that, but that's a really good one word description, because whenever you hear your music, there is that, there's this, you know, you can move to it. Mm-hmm. Which is a fun nod to your first video off the new record with all your dancing.
That's the thing. If I can't dance to it, I ain't gonna write it.
Well, it's, you know, then when I went back and I was reading about some of the Sly and the Family Stone and your love for, you know, Stevie Wonder and these guys, I thought, man, I can hear all this stuff in his music. And I think that this is why it somehow filtered through you and your fingers and your experience when you started to write music. It had such, in going back to the regard statement in the music community, I think it just had this. I think people could feel this, these influences.
There was a void in rock and roll at that moment for that. And I think, you know, we kind of carried the torch. Yeah. It's 70s, we sound like 70s bands. We sound like, I find all kinds of different genres I like to mix together. So, that's the result of it. You know, this is what happens. It's like this combination of things that everyone feels like it's familiar, but it ain't. I remember when our first record came out, the biggest comment in the industry was, this stuff sounds so familiar, but it's not. And I didn't understand what that meant until years later. You know, as you, the older you get, the more you do what you do, you start to figure out what you're doing. And I'm like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's approachable because there's something about it that's familiar.
Yeah.
Yet it's surprising. And I know this sounds like a contradiction, but even in the new music that I've been listening to over the past, you know, a couple of days, you take these turns in terms of the chord progressions that are unpredictable. And then the way you weave your vocal lines on top of them do the same thing. But yet there's just this, you know, what I love about that, Doug, is as a music listener, I listen to so much music that when I start to be able to predict the next thing, I kind of just lose interest. And that never happens with your music for me.
Good.
Go these places I can't anticipate.
My sister even told me that about 20 years ago when I sent her Mr. Bulbous. She said, same thing. I do that on purpose. And the reason I do that on purpose is because that is the biggest thing that affects me when I hear music from bands, when they surprise me like that. It gives me goosebumps. I'll tell you a little story real quick. I was 16 years old, I think, and James Brown was on my record player. And I break down in a cold sweat. The chord drop was not where I thought it would go. And that was the first time in my life, I think, that I heard that you can go somewhere else, because all soul music was the same. Blues was the same. Rock and roll was the same. Nobody stepped outside the box. But in 66, James Brown gave us a different groove. And that hit me. And the other thing that got me was, back when I was about 10 and I heard Dave Brubeck take five. And I went, what is this timing? It was so interesting. And so I sat down to figure it out and I memorized verbally. I could sing and hum that song, that whole song to you as a child, because it was so surprising. And so that's always been my take on writing music. And Yes is the other band. When I heard Roundabout, I thought, now you can make up some crazy ass stuff over top of three-part harmonies and make it work. And I thought, okay, I got my formula and I ran with it in the gospel church. You know, I grew up in the gospel thing, and that's where all of the motion is, you know, the people shouting and jumping and screaming and waving their hands. And that's a part of who I am too. And so I, you know, and Led Zeppelin, when I first heard Led Zeppelin, I remember a friend of mine came over with this record and said, hey man, listen to this. It was like the first rock record really that I really ever heard. And he put, I put it on and I went, wow, that sounds like Booker T and the MGs without keyboards and and more heavier.
Yeah.
And I turned my head, and from that moment on, I stepped into the British invasion, you know, and that sort of kind of stayed, you know, the three-piece power trio, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you guys, it's interesting because you, your music is early on with King's X, you guys would get placed in different places and it all worked. Mm-hmm. Some people called you a progressive metal band. Some, some people have believed that you guys started grunge, cause there's a certain raw, interesting way that you approach the guitar. And all of this melting pot kind of came together. And on top of it, I'm glad that you mentioned your sort of gospel background, because the way you sing, the places where you decide to kind of get into a grit with your voice and emote, whether this is, you know, something that you're just doing naturally or something you're thinking about, it gave that music when you guys appeared on the scene something unique. It was not just the raspy guy who was trying to just be a power metal dude, and it was not it was just not all clean. It had this very sort of emotional core that a lot of that music was missing.
I remember.
Yeah, you were there.
Yeah. A lot of the 80s music from the California 80s music, you know, the Sunset Strip stuff, I couldn't deal with, because the singers, they were like having Marshalls on 10. They had great tone, but I couldn't hear anything else other than that tone. And so it turned into white noise to me. And I've always been someone that likes variety in the music and in the aspects, every aspect of it, because if you don't put the variety in it, then people can't hear you anymore. It's just like now when they say that kids' ears are becoming fatigued because we're brickwalling all our music and it's digits. And so this flat sound comes at us and our ears can't distinguish the highs, the lows, the depth, the highs anymore. And so our ears don't know how to act. And that's the whole point about making music, is you got to give your ears that breathing spot, and like with playing bass, everything. And I don't know where I'm going with this, because I forgot what the question was.
I was just talking about the lack of emotion in some of the music that was contemporary with you.
Okay, that's my point. You know, when people naturally sing, Robert Plant, for instance, he had a really raspy voice, but you could feel the heart. You could feel the up and down and the vibrations that he was doing. When it got to the 80s, it just sounded like everybody was trying to sound like Robert Plant, but they didn't know how to shake the string like a guitar player. Just no vibrato. He's playing the notes. And I had a hard time with that. But the thing was, I've always been like a soul singer. My heroes were always Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin and like Stevie Wonder and Sly and the Family Stone, and even going further back, Little Richard and Ray Charles, and then Mahalia Jackson and Mavis Staples. I mean, we go back to day one where I heard these people that were giving me goosebumps as a child. And so all I wanted to do was emulate them. And even when it came to rock music in the 70s, which was, you know, I was in my 20s, so that was, you know, our generation. Even in rock music, everybody sang like they were black. I mean, Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water, Robert Plant, all of them, they sounded like soul blues singers. Yeah. And so I was just a part of that genre of music. I sang like they did. Even Ritchie Blackmore asked me to join Deep Purple right when King's X started, and Kansas asked me too. And you think about it, all their singers, I could sing like them because they're soul singers. They were just white. So I just came 10 years later when people forgot about it, and punk rock came, and the Sex Pistols, and then Poison and all that stuff came.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we had forgotten about that type of a singing. And here I am from that generation. And I didn't look like it. Everybody, you know, I was 40 years old almost when the first record came out, and everybody thought I was 20. So they thought I was just as young and bringing something new to the program. I've been doing that for 20 years before that.
Yeah, you know, you lead me to another question I wanted to ask with that answer, because mm-hmm. Not to throw shade on a whole generation of music, because there's a lot of that I still love, but mm-hmm. there was a degree to which a lot of the 80s rock and metal was really just that time's pop music.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, it wasn't meant to be very deep. Kind of was so shallow mm-hmm. by design. You know, we're going to party, we're going to go have fun, whatever we're going to do. When you guys came along, the fact that your voice kind of matches this soulfulness, you married that to music and to lyricism, that they all worked together. So mm-hmm. at that time, you were coming along, you were singing differently, you were singing with more of an emotional center, I think. Like the guys you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were doing this music that was taking interesting chord progression turns that made people like stand up and listen. And then on top of all of that, you had a lyrical approach that was more substantive than some mm-hmm. of your early contemporaries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is not the all of it, but there's at least some of the early music that you were nodding to writers like C.S. Lewis. I'm not so much concerned with that or interested in that as I am like the larger idea of, you know, where the thrust of your lyricism came from, because you wrote about some really thought provoking and still do, but that also was atypical at the time.
Mm. When I used to write straightforward lyrics in the 70s, coming from I was a Jesus freak back then. I was a Christian. I am not now, but back in my 20s, that was my life. And we were taught as Christians to sing about Jesus wants to save you. Jesus loves you. We know you're suffering. He will make you happy. All that kind of bullshit. And so I was writing lyrics like that all the time. And then I heard when U2 came out with Gloria and Bono saying, about how he felt about his religion and his questions about his religion and the humility that came through his lyrics. And at that point I thought, that's what's missing. I'm not being honest. And I thought, why don't you sing about what you feel like he is? This is where it's at. You just only can sing about how you feel. The rest of this stuff is just, you're not being real. And so that's how it started. And I dug into myself and said, what is this that gives me hope in the middle of the night? It's like, I believed in God, but I wasn't sure. Is this really real? Or am I just scared and afraid of going to hell? Like in Mission, you know, are we just a social get together to hang out? And because we're scared we're going to go to hell, or the missionary or the preacher, is this is really true or not? I don't know. And it was always that from the beginning. I never set out in King's X to say we're Christians and follow Jesus. It was always, y'all better question what you believe in, because I'm not buying this, but I'm still a part of this at this moment.
Yeah.
And that's where I was coming from. And I found my way out, you know, and lyrically it helped me get out, you know, on the song. In Ear Candy, I had to run, I had to hide in the world outside. Better place out there, God's everywhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's there's a certain authenticity that comes through your lyrics when you start just writing from, places of personal feelings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think people connected with that. And I think people of all stripes connected with it.
I think so too.
And I think it's, you know, I think people have regard for that, whether they share the ideology or not.
Oh yeah.
Because as you and I know, there's folks of all different kind of mm-hmm. systems, but there's a, what I love about it, and this sounds a little maudlin, but there's also in this community, there's something shared, and it's beautiful that we do that. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this because I think it infuses your most in Joy Bomb. I was smiling the whole damn time I was listening to that record.
Yes. It means a lot to me. It really does.
But I still want to do some buildup because you've done so much. All of my friends would beat me senseless if I didn't talk to you more about some of the other things you've done.
Okay.
One of the interesting things that you did early on that was also really, really fresh, and it's permeated your music ever since, is your sense of melody and harmony. In fact, when I read the quote that I hadn't heard before that Jeff Ament, who you've worked with, said you invented, King's X invented grunge. And then I was listening, I've been listening to a whole bunch of your music. I started listening to the harmonies. I thought, man, this is where Alice in Chains got it. And if they didn't, oh my gosh, because the way the harmonies you would choose is very reminiscent of harmonies that define that group.
Well, Lenny told us that. Lenny said to Jerry one time, he said, keep writing great songs that we can keep ripping you off. and we hugged him and we went and had a drink and got drunk.
Yeah.
That was around the second, between Rooster, I mean, between the second and first record. That's when we started hanging out.
That does not surprise me at all.
Yeah, we played Seattle when our first record came out, and Jeff and a couple other people from some other grunge bands told me that almost every musician in town was there, and they said that any national band that came to Seattle, everybody went to see because nobody ever came to Seattle. It was one of those places. They had a great music scene, you know, that whole thing, but nobody ever came. And when we came and played, and I remember Jeff did say to me that he went and saw Alice in Chains a month later after we had played, and he said they had this broody, groovy kind of melodic kind of thing happening. And he just thought, yeah. And he also said there are many bands in town that took some of that approach, drop beat tune, groove a little bit more, get that Black Sabbath in your punk rock, you know. Yeah. And so I think that we helped. I hate it. Sometimes I don't want to say we invented grunge. It's this way. There's a part of our music that inspired them to explore the guitar and music in a different way than that, because we were all looking for something new because we were sick of the late 80s music. We're sick of all that stuff. Even as much as they loved Guns N' Roses, they knew we had to move on. And I think they found some things in our music and took off with it. Somebody told me one time, they said one song by King's X, you can start several genres of music in one song. And I thought, wow, you know, but then I think about it. Yeah, there are some bands that sound like a certain part of something that we came up with, which we stole from somebody else, you know, with our little twist, because nobody ever comes up with nothing. I mean, you got to get it from somewhere. Yeah. So, but I love it that Jeff said that, because other than Jeff, when it comes to people in the media, rock people and people from Seattle, we've never been given that credit. It's always been you can name the bands that they say started it. And I've watched a couple of videos on how grunge started, and we're nowhere in there at all, not even the thought. I remember when they made that Sleepless in Seattle and all those guys were in the movie, Jeff Ament told me that he took as many posters of King's X as he could and put them all over the wall so that when they filmed, they'd see that poster. He said they filmed around every King's X poster and only showed the old, you know, the classic punk rock ones and stuff. And he said he was really pissed. And yeah, the same thing, like Dime did that too. Dime was on, they did an interview with him and they asked him some of his favorite bands. And he did a whole spiel on King's X and told them, I will be upset if you don't play this, and they cut it out, but they talked about everything else. We've in the media, for some reason, that always gets emoted, because that's when I felt like, well, maybe, you know, maybe I'm just the guy running like Little Richard. Oh, I started rock and roll, but I didn't, you know, maybe, you know, I mean, I didn't want to be that guy. So I just don't say nothing about it much anymore. If somebody brings it up, I'll tell them my side of the story, but I don't walk out anymore saying, hey, man, we started that shit. You know,
yeah,
we didn't.
You make two good, really good points there. The first is nobody gets anything in a vacuum, you know. But secondly, you bringing your influences to bear in all of the different ways you did in writing your music had a significant influence. I hadn't even heard this, other than the Jeff quote. But when I was listening to the track Out of the Silent Planet, mm-hmm. which goes way the hell back.
Yeah.
I immediately heard Alice in Chains.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, okay. So, and I love Alice in Chains, but I was like, okay, I can see where they were starting to listen around and like take mm-hmm. their own influences. So that, and I'm from Seattle. I'm in Seattle.
Cool.
So I'll represent for Seattle that you have your influence on this, mm-hmm. In our scene.
Well, see me, Jerry Cantrell and Dime and Rex and me, and a bunch of the other ones too. We hung out a lot. You know, and we all influenced each other. They'll tell you how much we influenced them, and I'll tell them how much they pushed us to keep pushing on. You know, I saw Pantera when they did with their first record. They came out on stage and played the whole record, and we didn't know they had a record deal. Cowboys from Hell, it just blew us away. And then I remember going backstage going, dude, what the fuck are you guys doing? And he goes, dude, Gretchen goes to Nebraska. What's going on, you know? And then we, you know, it was that camaraderie all the time. It was just so great that we were all bugging on each other and pushing each other.
Yeah. Well,
I remember when Jerry wrote Rooster, I was at Lollapalooza and I went backstage and he says, dude, I got this riff. Check this out. And he played the riff to the Rooster. And I was going, fuck yeah, you know? And, you know, it's like, those were the days back then that we were all like, running together. They did look up. I remember Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains, or somebody, a couple people from the camp said, we can't wait till we can open up for you. Well, ironically, we opened up for them, you know, more than, you know, so that's how fate goes. Alice in Chains did open for us one time and then they blew up. But we all go way back. We're just good buds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fun to hear. And it is, I mean, these are the vagaries of the industry that are hard to figure out. Like I was saying up front, you guys have been amazingly successful. I don't want to marginalize that, but there should have been more, and maybe there still will be in terms of commercial success. Is that in the music circles, you guys, your bona fides are unquestioned.
You know, it's like at this point in my career and at my age, I like the title that I have because it puts everything together, you know, that, you know, when you like Lemmy or like somebody that's just been here and done it, they didn't get rich, but everybody knows who they are. People have been influenced by them. Everybody loves them. They're still approachable. You can still hang out with them, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, we're just one of the guys. And that's what I am now. I don't feel like we didn't make it or we didn't sell enough records or this or that. It doesn't matter anymore. I got another title. When they say this, they put this legend thing on it. And I laugh and go, And then I go, well, I don't know how to take that, but I understand the concept is that forget about the ramifications and negative things. It's look at the picture. And then you go, yeah, cool. And I go, okay, I can die happy knowing that, you know, I'm a part of rock and roll. And what more could you want? What more could you ask for? You know?
No, you make, I'm glad you said that. Cause you're right. Like, I was fixating too much on wishing that more people had bought your albums when the reality is,
oh, don't get me wrong. I wish they did. I tell you what, when we played Woodstock 94 in front of 300,000 people at the most perfect time, at the show, USA Today said we were one of the top five bands besides Metallica, Nine Inch Nails, and I forgot who the rest was. MTV said we woke up the crowd, and Howard Stern said that we blew everybody away. We sold 250 records in the upper state New York area, and the record tanked. And that's when we realized your dream is not going to happen. So it's time to buckle down and just make music that you want to make and fuck the rest. And that's what we did.
Well, and that's the point I was coming to after kind of listening to you talk for a minute is you're a fixture. Like when your name is brought up, like it conjures for people who are real music heads or musicians, something definite. I'll just come to it now. One of my favorite groups is a band called Dream Theater.
Oh yeah.
And you were on their Falling Into Infinity album, mm-hmm. on I'm blanking the track.
Lines in the Sand, yeah.
And I remember I hadn't read the liner notes, and then I heard that song, and then I hear all this voice come in on the chorus. I'm like, that's Doug. You know, that's Doug.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, and they're at one extreme of like sort of musicianship that holds you in this regard. Mm-hmm. So you're right. Like, I know that titles like Legend can seem weighty, but it's apropos, I think, from my perspective, that this is the way that you're regarded. We still want people to buy your albums, but like, it's bigger than that. Like, yeah. Your legacy is bigger than that.
Yeah, it is. And that's what I'm happy about now. Now I look back and I'd rather be there than have that one hit wonder and have a whole lot of money and have nothing but drama and be the scandal of the world and going down that road. Cause I would have mentally and the whole deal, I wasn't ready for all that. You know, I wear my heart on my sleeve and I'm too nice. They would have just ate me for lunch and left me to dry with a whole bunch of money somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not what you want.
No, that's right. There's, I know too many bands that had that one hit that are, you know, they play the casino here every couple mm-hmm. of years. And
our heroes that killed, or our friends who killed themselves. You know, I mean, I knew Chris, I knew Chester, you know, and it's like they had everything.
Yeah.
You know, but there was something missing, you know. So I go, I didn't want to, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm saying is I've settled with where I've ended up at.
Well, you're still making amazing music, and I want to.
Yeah. I shouldn't say ended up. You're right.
No. And we're going to come to your. I just want to mention a couple things before we talk about your mm-hmm. Joy Bomb. And this is mostly for folks who maybe just have only known you from King's X or something.
Or never.
But yeah, plenty of folks who have not heard you or the music that you're most noted for. But you have many, many meaningful additional projects. Things like KXM with George Lynch and Ray Luzier, Super Shine with Bruce Franklin and Jeff Olson. I won't read them all because there's so many. We will include in our show notes pointers to these things. But there is a huge list of luminary musicians that Doug has collaborated with, started. That have done multiple records, and the music is always first rate. And very interestingly, it's not, you may love King's X, but don't go into it thinking it's just another King's X record. Doug's very good at, in these collaborative scenarios, doing music that has its own flavor as a consequence of the songwriting that he does with these other musicians. And I've been sampling it all, Doug. I will be honest, I hadn't heard every single track in all these bands, but I've been like with the fire hose and I've been consuming it. And so I can honestly say to people who are seeing this now and that are going to see it later, there is a wealth of music that you have done in your career that deserves to be heard. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation. So much good stuff. And then there's a whole thing I had prepared, Doug. I want to get to your record, but there's a whole thing I had prepared on the many guest appearances you've done, where it's not where it's not a collaboration, but someone said, we want Doug to come sing on mm-hmm. this tune, whether it's Billy. I had Billy Sheehan on the show. And
awesome. I love Billy.
And I talked to him. I did the same thing with Billy. I went through his whole, and I found all this music I didn't know about. And you're on the record, Holy Cow, which is an amazing record. And there you are on the track Turning Point. I mentioned Dream Theater, and then you've been in a bunch of really, really great tribute albums where you're asked to cover Hendrix or Van Halen or Metallica. These are just more pointers to the fact that when people are doing meaningful work and they wanted this collaborative sense, Doug's a guy that's on that list. And it goes back to what we were saying before. You've kind of reached this status where it's about the music. It's not because you had one particular song that made you a guitar hero. And I have to say this, you actually stood in for Corey Glover, he's got a real soulful voice too. He was off singing the part of Satan in Jesus Christ Superstar, I think, or part of Judas, rather.
Yeah, I did 10 shows in Europe with him.
That's amazing. Fun. I would love to have seen that.
I'm going to put the video out one of these days. We have a filming of one of the shows because we did festivals in Europe and they have the big screens on the side of the stages and stuff. So I have a tape of or a CD of one of the camera things, you know, and it's plugged straight into the board too. So it's kind of cool.
Dude, yeah, put that out. That would be awesome. But I'm rushing over this part because I want to get to the new record.
Right.
But I will just sort of summarize by saying that there's a lot of bands that Doug has either formed or helped form, has multiple records. There's a whole list of appearances and a bunch of tribute work, his distinctive vocal stylings and bass playing. We didn't even talk about some of the interesting things that you do with bass. Like the you know, your use of distortion, the 12 string that you play that have helped create these sounds that people hold so dear with your music. But I summarize that only because the new record's so good. And, you know, after all of this music that you've created, you write this record, I think largely during the COVID lockdown.
Sort of, kind of. Right? I never stopped writing. And so I don't know. A couple songs are 20 years old and the rest of them span from all the way till now. I just write and write. And when words come to me, then I pull the song out, you know?
Okay. Well, it's a great record. And I don't say that because you're here in front of me on Zoom or because I've loved you forever. I listened to it and I just realized after the very first track, I was just smiling thinking, he's doing it again. He's surprising me. He's surprising me with the chord changes. He's surprising me with not just the changes, but the part. She'll go into a new part and it's got a different sensibility. And then the way you weave it all together with your voice. And so before I forget, I want everybody to go and get this record and listen to this record. But I want to talk, Doug, about some of the tunes. So first of all, you released a video for Key Changer. And that's where I started smiling because I watched that one first. It's just joyful. And so then I thought, okay, well, I don't know where the vibe that he came to with the album title, but, you dancing there to this music was just a joy. The music gives you that feeling. And I think one of the things that was refreshing about it to me is, and I like all kinds of music, but there's not enough music that just makes you feel that way right now. You know, does that make sense?
I agree. And that's exactly why I wrote that song.
Yeah. Yeah. You can tell it's important. All the emotions are important, right? And it's all valid if you're writing through an authentic place.
Lyrically, anyway, the riff was just me trying to be funky and dance to it. But yeah. I thought to myself, what can I sing on here? And I thought we're in the middle of a pandemic and everybody's freaking out. And I thought, let's just lighten up a bit, you know?
Yeah.
So that's where it came from.
Yeah. I'm glad you wrote that tune.
Thank you.
There's a lot of flavors on this that I think are relevant.
Yeah.
With everything we're going through for sure. And I want to talk about some of them.
Okay.
But that's one that is, there's not enough songs that help us just kind of relax a little bit and realize that life can and should be joyful at least in some part.
Some people call it over my head too.
Oh no, it's a great track and the video is really fun.
Thanks.
So that'll be easy for people to get to. We'll be sure we can point them to that.
Awesome.
But there's there's 13 tracks on it. And of course I had some favorites. So there's a handful I want to talk about. You have the song called A Long Way Home.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened really closely to this because I was trying to figure out some of the things I loved about it. And this is, I think, part and parcel of a lot of the work you've done, but you are very artful with the use of passing tones and half steps. I don't know if you're aware of this or if you do it like just organically and if this comes from influences, but I realize that this is part of what it keeps it unpredictable for me is I would expect you to go to a third or to a fifth or to do some kind of vocal turn. You don't, you do this other thing. And at first I think, oh man, it's going off the rails. And then all of a sudden it resolves to something so pleasing.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's what I try. You're the only person in the world has ever explained what's going on in my head when I'm doing that. That's cool. Cause I couldn't even explain it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to sit down and kind of listen.
And it's got to resolve. If it don't resolve, it don't make sense.
Yeah. And you do this, you have some chord progressions where like instinctively, cause I'm also a vocalist, instinctively, I would have said, well, I would have told a guitar player to play a different chord because that's not where my notes should go. You didn't do that. I got the feeling you wrote the progression you wanted because you had some different chords, and then you took the vocal line. You did this on the song "Long Live Love."
Yeah,
and that chord progression on the chorus where you made some vocal choices. At first, I was like, "That's not what I was hearing," and then when I just stopped and listened to what you were singing, it was so beautifully different. This is the surprise that I talk about.
Cool.
That you do that. There's not enough of it in songwriting.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. So, but the long.
Somebody's listening. Somebody's listening. Cool.
I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I had to say the other thing you do that you did quite a bit on this record. You've done it before, of course, but I want to say it because I think it's a thing that people should listen for with this record is you do what I find to be a blues styling where there's a lyrical phrase and you repeat it multiple times, but each time you do it, the inflection is different. The melody is a little bit different. And so it's as though you're kind of really sort of emphasizing a point, but you do it in this musical way that it refreshes each time you sing it. And I know so many blues guys that do this and you just get this, it becomes emotional because you realize that the phrase is important and you keep singing it to me with this unique styling, whether you're going to do some sort of rasp in your voice or you change the melody subtly or it gets a little bit more dynamic. I wanted to know, like, when you're doing your songwriting, do you think about these kinds of things as much as I'm hearing them? Or is it just kind of like you responding to the music?
No, I think about those things because I've written so many lyrics and so many melodies. I'm always trying to, it's sort of like the way the history of music, it starts out simple, then it gets complicated. Then somebody brings it back to ground zero, Beatles, then Little Richard did it. Beatles did it. Then you go, you know, Led Zeppelin and you go Sex Pistols. Everybody brings it back. And so for me, it's the same thing. I'll start making up melodies and I'll be like Todd Rundgren all over the place and Elvis Costello. And then one day I just think, why don't you just sing like the old black lady out in the cotton field? Oh, Lord, when you gonna come? Oh, Lord, when you gonna come? Oh, Lord, when you gonna come? Oh, Lord. And every time you say it, you feel like you're saying, when are you gonna come? When in your heart? It's like it's an emotional thing, and I know they used to do that, and we all got away from it. And sometimes in my lyric writing or melody writing, I want to find some variety in it. I don't want to sing the same old boring Beatle melody you know that I put in every record. You know, or you know, I have a bunch of tricks and I use them all, but I'm looking for more tricks. You know, so that I can make a picture with a little slightly different color. Yeah. Yeah,
I'm glad you gave us that impromptu example because that's exactly what I was talking about. It's not done very much in modern music, where you know I don't hear it anyway. Maybe I'm listening to the wrong stuff.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody really knows much. I mean, that's just a concept that I think is almost forgotten.
Yeah, yeah, but that's exactly right. Is when you repeat those phrases, those important. As simple as the lyric may be, the way you re-sing it, it builds this emotional weight. And that's all through this Joy Bomb record. Awesome. whether it's truly just like a joyful song or something that's got a little bit more, you know, maybe the theme's a little heavier or meant to be a little bit more thought provoking. In fact, speaking of Beatlesque, the tune, I thought this spontaneously when I was listening to Love and Fear, I really was feeling a Beatles vibe on some of that.
A lot of people said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's something cool. I don't know what it was, but
I can see that because they used to do every now and then they do that poppy song. That poppy white thing that you go on like American Bandstand and Ed Sullivan back in the 50s, you know.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And the moral of the story says my mama said that is the song. I mean, it was like that whole thing, I was just thinking about 30s and 40s and when people would sing and stuff and go, and then put the slide part on it. And I'm going, wow, I put it on the record.
But you know what? I have to tell you I think I got this right because I didn't have any lyric notes, but you got a line in that tune that I think says this: close your eyes and empathize. Free your mind and your ass will follow.
Yeah, it's close your eyes, empathize, see through someone else's eyes.
Okay.
Someone else's eyes, free your mind and your ass will follow. These are changing times. Yeah.
Yeah. I love, what a great lyric. Free your mind and your ass will follow. Go ahead.
Play Funkadelic Maggot Brain in the beginning of it says, free your mind and your ass will follow. The kingdom of heaven is within. Oh, no, that's the first Funkadelic record back in 70. That's where I really got that from. Free your mind and your ass will follow. George Clinton.
it's a great turn of phrase. And it's so expressive. I had to go back and re-listen to that tune several times.
Awesome,
just to kind of
awesome.
Take in.
I always thought that song would be, that was the filler of the record. I'm so shocked that more people have talked about that song than any other song on the record.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It's a great tune. And in all transparency, I'm not the biggest Beatles fan. So
I'm not either.
I get crucified every time I say that to people. They're like, well, what's wrong with you? I said, I don't know. It just, for some reason, it doesn't penetrate very deep for me either. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say same thing here. I agree. Totally agree with you. The reason that my contribution of Beatle things into my music and into King's X is because the Beatles were so big in my day of really soaking the music in. I never bought the records. I never listened to the music. Why is it that I know all the songs and everything about them? Because it was Beatlemania. You couldn't do anything without Beatles in your face. Yeah. And as an artist and as a songwriter, when you hear some of those Beatle harmonies or some of those Beatle things or bass line or something, oh, wow, you're inspired by it. And so, you know, Jerry and Ty would say, man, your harmonies sound like Beatles. Are you really listening to the Beatles? I go, no, it's just when I heard the Beatles do that, it sounded cool. So I thought I'd put it in the song. You know, it's influences from, it's not being afraid to take all your influences and put them in one song and somehow to take that brush and smear it together somehow. Don't be afraid, because you might come up with something a different color.
Oh, people are going to hate me for saying this, but there's not even for me a choice between picking up a Beatles record or picking up any of the records that you've written.
Awesome. Thanks.
Your music. There's so much more to commend it. And I know I didn't grow up during Beatles mania.
Yeah. And that's the difference. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to ask you and talk to you about the song Like a Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
This is my favorite track on the record.
Awesome.
This is another one. When you got to the chorus, I could no more have predicted that than I could. I was like, and then as soon as it played, it was so beautifully correct. And the harmonies for that are haunting. It's, I just want to know, can you just give me a little bit of the genesis of that song? Cause I love it so much.
Honest to God, I love Meshuggah. They're one of my favorite bands among other bands. And they're just they're magical. And I've gotten to know them, and I found out that they were King's X fans, and they played our records. And we had a great conversation and hang the first time I met him. And I went and got me some 8-string guitars and from Schecter. And it's been sitting around for a while, and I've been dabbling with songs, but I pulled it out and thought, let me write me something really low, like Meshuggah. And I thought, well, I can't copy them, you know, trying to make some fucked up math. But I thought about, you know, just that sensibility. And I took my 8-string guitar up and just played the fret, the middle fret note in the open string all the way down the neck. So I went, it was a D string, high D, low D. The next string was a D or a G down, and then all the way down to E or whatever it was. And I just wanted to hear the tones. And I thought, that's kind of a fucked up melody. And so I pulled the drums up and all of I said, that's eerie sounding. And I thought, let me see if I can come up with something over that. And I felt this darkness about it. And then when I feel like Howling Like a Wolf came into my mind, then I just thought of just frustration and how everybody's feeling right now. And a Gotham movie where, you know, somebody's on the roof and he's just howling at the moon, and the city streets are hustle and bustle and lights are everywhere, and everybody's just frustrated. And, you know, and that's kind of where it came from word-wise. And musically, it was sort of, you know, every song I write is an experiment. And I try to go outside the box when it comes to, if I make a part up, I go, what comes next? Should I go to the obvious place? Or should I go to the least obvious place? Or should I go to a kind of, you know, and so I choose. I sit there and I'll sit there and I'll go, nah, that's too common. I'll play, okay, where can I go from this? And I'll go back and I'll go, okay, that's all it needs, just that little half step. Or sometimes I'll play a riff and I'll do the riff a half step up, only half the riff, and then go back to the riff again, and I go, well, that's kind of fucked up, and I'm not bored now, and I laugh about it, and I finish it, and then I go, and you know, I shame on me, but I will say that if someone says, Doug, put a melody on this, I'll do it, no matter how fucked up that song is. I'll say I can do that, yeah. And then I walk away, and it might take me months and months and months to come up with something. And I go, oh my god, what kind of, I can't believe I said that. Like, I'm the great god of melodies. But sooner or later, I'll find something that I think works or is okay or is great, you know. But I have an ego about that, because the reason why is because watching Yes all the time, I'm going, John Anderson could sing some of the craziest melodies over some of the Yes music. And I thought, this is what I want to do. It's just like you see a color and you want to paint it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You have an uncanny ability to create distinctive, memorable melodies over music that is not atonal, but it's unpredictable. And so the melodic choices are not predictable. And that when I listened to this Like a Wolf, but then it became my favorite track. I kept listening to it, and these parts that were changing and being very, and then you did this other thing. I don't know if you meant to do this, but you did a sort of a guitar solo part. And it just sounds to me like a wolf howling. Was that intentional, or am I just, is that just my experience of the song?
Yeah. Well, Randy McStein did the lead on that song.
Okay.
And I can hear that. I wonder, you know, cause I haven't really talked to him about what he was thinking, cause I'm so proud of him for what he did on it. I've known him since he was 14, and he's been playing just amazing since he was a kid. And so I asked him to play on it, and knowing Randy, that is probably what he was going for.
There's a sound, man. That. Is that there's a lead phrase that is played after one of the choruses.
Right.
And before it gets into any sort of real neck movement. And, and the way the tone and the way that plays, it just, I got this picture of this wolf howling and just in that repeat the way they do, man. And maybe that's just because I was in grooving on the tune. And so my mind was working, whether your guy was meaning it or not, but regardless, it has the effect. So
cool. I'll tell them too.
Tell them, yeah, man. This is such a good record. The before I let you go, I just have two more
sure.
things I want to hit, if that's okay.
No rush. Take your time.
One is that I read some of the commentary that you put out about the record and about and I think this probably weaves in some of the other tracks on the record about we kind of being in this place at a sort of national stage where people I think that you said you can't even say why can't we get along, mm-hmm. but there's such division that I mean there used to be that old phrase, well, let's just agree to disagree, and then people could then go on and have dinner or they could do whatever and realize that the Venn diagram of their humanity overlaps more than the difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you said this about it. I just wanted to see if I could convince you to tell us a little more about that, because I love that you were, I guess, bold enough to kind of make this statement, because of course we're going to have things that people are never going to agree about, mm-hmm. but it's become so polarized that people now aren't talking at all.
Yeah. Right? I used to think, you know, a lot that goes in my mind all the time when it comes to my relationships with people is always to understand where they're coming from so I can understand what they're doing instead of getting mad or upset. And I can and we can articulate how we feel so that we can learn to live with each other in a way that's not doesn't have conflict. And I'm always searching for new ways to make peace, find out a friendship, I call it. Wrote a song about it a long time ago. And my whole life has been that, is how do you become good friends with people? You get to know them, you get to understand them, you get to love them. And I was comfortable being able to get with people and agree and disagreeably, and everybody's fine. And I felt like I was getting good at it even, and I was happy about it, having lots of less, you know, drama and stuff. And then all of a sudden, algorithm comes in. And all of a sudden, all of us are watching our YouTube or you know, our phones or whatever, and Big Al up there, you know, Big Brother, he's watching everything that we do, and then he feeds us everything that we keep looking at. And by the time, and so this is when, how many years, 10 years or so since all this started happening. So we've got people to a point where there is not one person who is on the phone that has the same reality as you, not one person. And everything that they think, or anything that you think of, you can find a community that will embrace you and ask you to come live with them and embrace their belief until you're consumed with it. And then all of a sudden, you don't trust anyone, and we've gone back to tribes. That's what the internet has done. It's created tribes like when we were cavemen.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to agree with you. I went to a high school that was what we called port of entry, meaning it had all the ESL programs. So all of the tribalism that's grown up like in the last 10 years or so wasn't a part of my life.
No.
I rub shoulders with every make and model of human you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And that just seemed like fine. And it was more for us about, if you were an asshole, you're an asshole. Had nothing to do with anything else.
Right.
So I marvel a little bit that it seems like we're regressing.
We are. We have.
Yeah.
I don't know any way out. At this point, I don't see any way out. Even if they shut all our computers off, we've already got our tribes.
Yeah.
And none of them are ever going to be open to outside influence. Let's go start with religion on the way down. They're not going to hope. It's over. The only thing I believe that can change is a flood or alien invasion, where we all drop our guard and go fight for humanity.
Some unifying crisis.
Right. Some unifying crisis. Thank you. That's a better way to put it.
Yeah. No, I hate to say it, but I've thought this, you know, I'm a student of history, and there've been times, usually it's at a national level, often at an international level, where there's some force for evil or, you know, badness in the world, mm-hmm. that people realize we have to get together to like oppose it. Mm-hmm. And in the interest of doing that, they pull together in some way. And I've thought, we've had a long time since we've really had anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the midst of this, what you said, you know, we get, it bothers me personally, and as a person who is both a musician and a lover of music, that the algorithm always feeds back to me the same stuff, meaning there are probably some really great records that coming out this this week. The algorithm's never going to show me.
Right.
Is there
right,
going to say, yeah.
Go ahead. I just got a magazine with Grinder Blues in it, and I opened the magazine up, and there's probably 200 new releases of metal bands. I didn't even know metal existed anymore.
Yeah.
Honest to God. It's like, where's all the rock and roll? Where's, you know, it's like we don't have. And so everything is out there. That's the sad thing about it. And I don't know how to, you know, go ahead. Keep talking.
No. I was just kind of, I think, underscoring your point is whether it's by pernicious design or whether it's just a consequence of the, you know, I think there is a degree to which big tech writes its programs and writes itself in the interest of driving more revenue.
Right. It's all about the money. Follow the money every time.
Yeah.
And you know where it's going. It's never for us, no matter what they say. It's all about what they can get out of us and not give back to us. And they've proven that. And I can't believe that they've used the internet to divide us and the media and the government to divide us so that we don't wake up to what they're doing. And that's what they've done it. They've cleverly designed it. It took them a while, but you know, that's why there's 1%.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's become, when you got groups that are trying to literally suppress speech, mm-hmm. That gets really concerning.
On both sides, because this is scary.
On you all know, the sides.
It's, yeah, because we don't want people making up shit, but then we don't want nobody stopping people saying what they want. How are you going to fix that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can't force people into believing anything. You know, people are going to believe what they want to believe.
Yeah.
What's true to their heart and logically has convinced them, you know, so... Jeez.
Yeah,
I look at it this way. I'm just going to make a record and keep making music. And hopefully us who are kind of in the middle that kind of see the way I see it can live in our little bubble. And hopefully something will come along to help us find a way out of this mess. You know, if anything, you know, I always say, if you don't like what Walmart is doing, if everybody that went to Walmart decided not to go, Walmart would change. And I tell people, it's all about the money. Why is it that when Rosa Parks wouldn't go to the back of the bus and they kicked her off? So what happened? No Black person took the bus for a month and only Black people rode the bus. So what did the bus company do? Okay, y'all niggas can get on the bus and sit up front now.
Yeah.
And was it for our freedom? It was for money. It's always, I can't stress that enough. Everything, follow the money.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think as consumers and as producers, you know, and people who are the vast majority who are working, if they kind of realize that the world doesn't turn unless they go do their job and mm-hmm. they buy their stuff, there's a lot of they could institute a lot of change if they'd be thoughtful about those choices,
right?
I think it's because you're right. I think we've gotten into tribes, and the tribes have become so insulated that they don't want to talk anymore.
Right.
They don't want to be. And so let's bring it back to your record. There's places mm-hmm. in your record where you kind of address this idea a little bit. And mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, it might be a bit romantic of an idea to say, well, you know, music can make a difference, but I actually am the person that thinks that there's some truth in that. As a quick aside, if you'll indulge me, I'm writing a book and I'm doing a bunch of research on the degree to which music has been part of the instigation of revolution over time mm-hmm. in all kinds of societies. And it's interesting that it plays a very meaningful part. And I think it's because whether it's a musical idea or a lyrical idea, it can create a touch point for people and this was my point earlier about the rock and metal community.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who have vastly different ideologies, but you can put them in the same room at a listening party. I'm going to a Halloween party with a very diverse set of friends. We're all mm-hmm. going to watch Behemoth together. be as cool. menacing as possible on Halloween, uh-huh. right? there's just not enough of that. And so your record, in its playful way at times, and in its thought-provoking way, and in all of this sort of the way we've talked about how it makes you listen because it goes places you don't expect. I like to think that there's at least some people who will hear it, and because they start to groove on it, they're gonna be introduced to an idea, or at least the notion that they don't need to tune someone out. And I know I'm sounding super high-minded, but this is precisely what I would want Doug Pinnick to do, is write this kind of record.
And that's why I did it, because that's what I'm thinking too. You know, yeah. I mean, if I'm gonna put a record out, you know, I don't want to just put a record out. I want to make a statement about why I made this record and yeah. what I have to say. You know, I'm that one. I love to talk and I love to tell people what I think, and that's, you know, and what a better platform, you know?
Well, this has got something for everybody. I know that's a very tired phrase, but there really is diversity on this record. And after so much music, to be able to write an album this good is a little infuriating to me.
Awesome. Awesome.
I have only one more question for you, my friend, and then yes. I'll leave you to your day. And that is,
thank you.
I love to know with folks I talk to, if there's some mountain you want to climb other than what you've climbed. And that could mean a style of music you've never dabbled in that you always thought you'd like to do. It could mean you want to build a boat. But is there something?
Well, aside from going to see all the alien things that are around the world, from the pyramids to the, you know, just down that rabbit hole of alien stuff, the things that are really here on the earth that you just can't argue with. But I think, what was it? I had it in the back of my mind. What I really wanted to say, though, was, my brain glitched. The thing is at 70 years old, which is statistically the best years of my life, and I'm having them, I kind of just look back and go, dude, you've been doing what you wanted to do and fun stuff and exciting things that most people only dream of, you know? And so it's like my life has always been this really great adventure that I didn't know was great till I got around 70. And then I look back and go, wow, dude, you got to do what you were doing. Why are you crying about everything? You know, why are you bummed out? You know, come on, let's take a look now and see what you learned. And that's kind of where I'm at now with Joy Bomb, because I used to cry a lot about crying my beer. I'm them drinking guys that cry, well, my mama left me and my daddy don't want me. You know, and I would sing about all these alienate things and hating myself and all this stuff, which was so true. But at this point in my life, nothing worse than a 70-year-old man walking up going, man, I'm still hurt over throwing. So it's like, no, you get up and go, hey, you can get there. Come on, you can get over that. Just hang on. You know, and say, hey, I'm climbing up the hill. Come on, you can do it. It's kind of tough up there. You're going through a midlife crisis. It's okay. Don't kill yourself. I went through it. You can be here. Just hang on. It takes time. You know, that's my outlook on everything now is to encourage people to keep going, because it can only get better. And if it does get worse, at least you believed it would get better. And that's what it's all about. At the end of the day, I mean, when you're in that hole, and if you're there for 10 years, you can still believe it's going to get better. And when it does, you're out. But if you go, oh, this is never going to get better, it's over, you know? And if it's over, then that's, you know, and as for dying, you know, I don't know what's over there. So I'm not that in a hurry to get there.
Yeah, that's right. So the last way I wanted to just kind of wrap this up is, what's next for you? What's on the horizon in terms of music or other things in your life?
More records, more music, you know, new KXM, new King's X. There'll be another Doug down the road somewhere. And whatever else comes my way, actually, you know, cause that's all I do is make music and play with people and it pays the bills too. So it's like, it's just what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a new King's X next year that's already on the way.
Yeah, we finished it. We're just trying to, there's a lot of stuff we have to go through to put it out. The COVID, just everything that's going on. So yeah. We're taking our time, going to do it right. Our fans are upset about it, but you know, what can I do?
Yeah.
You can't make the baby come too quick.
That's right. Well, good. I will look forward to all of that. Where's the best place that I can point people to learn the most about you? Is it your website?
Yeah. And I know you're going to put it all up there. I always say, just look up Doug Pinnick and you'll find more than you need to know about me. My best moments and my worst moments.
Yeah. No, that's a good thing, man. I like not to put too fine a point on it, but in a world where people are posting pictures that they do filters on themselves.
Right.
First,
right.
I love the human imperfections. So.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I try so hard. I mean, nowadays you can't take a picture without some kind of filter that's on it already. Yeah. You know, I notice, why do we all look like we're glossy or we're, our colors are so even? And I'm going, that's not what I look like when I see myself in the mirror. But, you know, and it's hard. You go out in the sun with the light shining real bright. And it should be able, the camera should be able to pick you up, and it just takes it and turns it into what it wants you to be. Yeah. You know, it's crazy. So I don't know if anybody really knows. I mean, all we got is body mis. What is it? Everybody's just learning to hate themselves. Put it that way.
Yeah, that's right. They have to present themselves in a certain way, and their digital. Mm-hmm. They call it their digital footprint.
Yeah,
I love it.
Go ahead.
No, sorry. No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and then you got people out there that are faking their whole bodies and lives and then making everybody feel bad because they don't look like that. So they go out and get the work done themselves, and they're not happy because happiness is not looking good, you know?
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. We just need some level set. And I COVID's been bad. It's exacerbated it because, you know, we've all had to live behind screens.
Right.
So we haven't been able to be in person and that whole thing with a, you know, I'm not a philosopher, but it sure seems like we miss that.
Yep. And hey, you know, life, and that's what philosophy is like, you know, looking at life the way it is and putting two and two together.
Well, man, this Joy Bomb's brilliant record. So good. We'll get the word out about it, and we will watch for all the future Doug Pinnick music that as long as you're going to give it to us.
I'm going to be giving it to you as long as I'm breathing, hopefully.
All right, man. Hey, just stick on the line so I can say a personal goodbye.
Okay, for sure. May the groove be with you.